Portland.
Tune in to Gabu every fourth Friday of the month at 8 p.m. for Squirrel Snow, the show where we broadcast galactic awareness, animal awareness, where we have fascinating conversations with movers and shakers in the fields of galactic awareness and animal awareness, and we play music that can raise our frequency of consciousness. Yeah, that is Squirrel Snow every fourth Friday of the month at 8 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO, Portland.
Spark Plug. Stunning, new sounds every other Wednesday 3 a.m. to 5:30 a.m. Join us and get connected.
You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland.
This is Rising Up with Sona Ali, a weekly news and analysis program focused on economic, racial, gender, justice, and more. I'm your host, Sona Ali Kolhatkar, and you can find us online at risingupwithsonali.com. This week, we'll examine what's at stake in the midterm elections, how Republicans are openly making it harder for people of color to vote, and how we can protect our rights. My guest will be Ana Lilia Mejia, co-executive director of the Center for Popular Democracy Action and former political director on Bernie Sanders' 2020 campaign. Then we'll turn to senior editor at Yes Magazine, Chris Winters, for context on the slide to fascism that today's conservative political movement represents, and how this midterm is the most important one in recent memory. Finally, Elizabeth Hines, editor of the new book Aftermath, Life in Post-Roe America, joins us for a conversation about abortion rights, its practical, moral, and political importance. That's coming up in just a moment. This is Rising Up with Sona Ali, and I'm your host, Sona Ali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. The 2022 midterm elections are upon us, and given the new calculus of polling since the 2016 presidential race, there is little that we can confidently predict. Still, that hasn't stopped corporate media outlets from claiming a surefire red wave in the House and even possibly in the Senate. Results are likely to not be firmed up for several days, however. And we turn in the meantime to analyst Ana Lilia Mejia to examine what's at stake for progressives in the midterm elections. Ana Lilia Mejia is the co-executive director of the Center for Popular Democracy Action, former deputy director at the U.S. Department of Labor Women's Bureau, and also former political director on Bernie Sanders' 2020 campaign. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So many people have been saying these midterm elections are unlike any others, but the tradition has been that the president's party tends to lose in the midterms. I'm loath to ask you to make any predictions, but what do you think is going to happen? And feel free to answer that in any way that you can. Do those kinds of standard sensibilities hold in this very new political reality we're in today?
So I think it's important to you mention that, you know, first, midterm elections in a president's first year have historically resulted in a loss of ground in terms of House and Senate seats. So if we see that through this election cycle, it's pretty much in alignment with what has happened to previous presidents, whether it was Trump or Bill Clinton or Obama. It wouldn't necessarily be an anomaly. Now, what we are seeing that is unprecedented are, one, the caliber of the candidates that are running for office across the country, as well as the tactics to essentially disenfranchise as many people as possible. So on one hand, you have an incredible number of, frankly, Republicans who either participated in the January 6th uprisings or supported or maybe didn't even denounce the uprisings. They have trafficked in what is called the big lie, the idea that the election was stolen from Donald Trump. And as a result, you know, we have a lot of dangerous characters running for office across the country in pivotal races, whether it's states as secretaries of states or governors or in the House and Senate. These are positions that will have lasting impact. The second thing that is very much unprecedented, history has taught us that this is a strategy utilized to negate the power of a rising Black and Brown electorate, and that is the systematic disenfranchisement of communities. Republicans in state after state have either sued for or made moves to essentially disenfranchise people. So right now I'm in Pennsylvania, and in Philadelphia we know that there were hundreds of voters who were whose ballots were early ballots were essentially thrown out because they some technicality, not an error in terms of the voting, but perhaps like a small error that is inconsequential. But as a result, all of these people who thought they had early voted have to return. So it's through these tactics and the caliber of candidates that this election really stands out for us.
And that's also one of the reasons why we may not know results for a few days, right? From what I'm seeing, Republicans have been encouraging their voters to show up on election day, not do early voting, and to show up specifically in some places, I believe in Georgia, in the last 2 hours of the voting day. And then they're going to make a big fuss about why results aren't known. So there's this bizarre, it seems as though, setting up of the system to fail. Show up, telling their voters to show up as late as possible, and then when results aren't tallied up in time, claim that there is some sort of problem, voter fraud, maybe election workers are up to some shenanigans as they claimed in the 2020 elections, and then claim victory. I mean, this is not just... it's so bald-faced in how they're trying to steal yet again an election.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it feels incomprehensible how something so blatant can pass muster with people who at the same time will say that they are upholders of the Constitution or believe in a democracy or even denounce the practices that we see in perhaps other nations or in other time periods. Here's the bottom line for us. I think we know that the policies that really motivate people, that make work work for working families, in particular wage-earning women, the policies that we know will essentially save humanity and the planet and stop climate change, the policies that we know will ensure that our children, that our elders, that Those most vulnerable in our communities have the resources that they need to not only survive, but thrive. Our policies that you know, are supported by the vast majority of people, certainly policies that have been in alignment with the Democratic Party platform, and most certainly policies that progressives had been advocating for years. These are popular ideas. We've won on the ideas. And so where is the opportunity to negate that? It's by siphoning away the power of these communities. It's by drying up the resources for civic education and most certainly civic participation. It's by gaming the system that you could beat wildly popular ideas that resonate with people. If the things that keep you up at night, the ability to pay your house mortgage or your rent, or ensure that your children have healthy food, or that you're able to sustain your job, are not being talked about. And what is, are these like false claims? And I mean, it's message confusion, it's voter confusion, it's systemic disenfranchisement. I mean, that's the only way that you could actually battle against popular ideas that most people want and support.
Well, the Republicans might counter that they are indeed talking about these issues because they're saying inflation is the problem. And because Democrats are in charge now and inflation is a problem, therefore, this is why voters should pick Republicans. I mean, they're making, you know, claims about how they are not going to be the ones cutting Social Security and Medicare. But if you look at their policies, that is precisely what they have planned. So they seem to be very successfully using a sleight of hand in being able to say, yes, we care about pocketbook issues, and then turn around and do exactly the opposite. But voters are not so, I mean, how are voters so easily being misled?
So I think I think you're absolutely right. There is in fact a scope shift happening when that argument is presented. The reality is that there is a global economic crisis. The United States is not alone. This is a crisis that was obviously triggered by both a pandemic and a war, the war in Ukraine. The reality is that for most people, there's so much noise in daily existence. Exactly these economic issues that Republicans fail to address are the same issues that are keeping people up at night, are forcing people to seek and work 2-3 jobs, are making it almost impossible for working families to stay afloat. And so when you're facing that kind of noise, it is very difficult to sift through all of the messaging, paid for messaging, massive amounts of money that is being dropped into misinformation, essentially, to lead people to either believe that, you know, essentially to gaslight Americans, to make them believe that what they see and what they feel is in fact not real, or to make folks like redirect their anger and their angst against communities that they feel different from. So I think it's a combination of noise, it's a combination of misinformation, and sadly, you know, the infrastructures and places where people would gather in community and get information from their peers is drying up more and more.
Republicans have already said that among the first things they'll do when they sweep the House and take control is to secure the border, which of course is coded language for attacking undocumented immigrants. Now, what about the...
That's coded language to attack any person of color.
Yeah.
Because the reality is that if you are targeted, if you're driving down a country road and you are targeted because you're brown, it won't matter that you have... that you were born in this nation. I am a great example. I was born and raised in this nation. My parents immigrated to this country, but I am cognizant that when people look at me or perhaps hear me speak, there are some assumptions that are being made. And that kind of animosity and animus has been fueled by, sadly, the previous president. And it's a strategy that is a century in the making. This idea of cleaving communities apart, of creating difference between white voters and Black voters or brown voters, this is not new. This has been happening in our nation, frankly, from its inception all the way through, you know, the Civil War, Reconstruction, the 60s, the 80s, the 90s, and now.
Among the other ways in which Republicans are trying to cheat their way into political power, we didn't mention overt voter intimidation. I mean, that used to be illegal, but we're seeing in places like Arizona where there are armed vigilantes of the ilk that we saw on January 6th in the nation's capital who are patrolling near ballot boxes. And we're also seeing the judiciary kind of shrug its shoulders because the Republicans have successfully made the judiciary managed to change the judiciary so that it's an ince pocket. Which seems as though we've sort of lost those checks and balances that we used to have.
That's actually spot on. I will say, you know, I don't want to actually blame the entirety of the Republican Party and in particular Republican voters. I think they are also being led astray by bad actors within their quote-unquote ranks who are willing to support authoritarianism, fascism, disenfranchisement, undermine the Constitution, and dismantle the three-legged stool that is American democracy. I mean, as a child, I was taught you have three branches of government, right? You have the legislative, the executive, and the judiciary. And those three are supposed to check and balance each other to ensure that there isn't disproportionate power placed on one or the other. Well, when you have, for example, out of the state of North Carolina, a challenge saying that the legislative has final say on redistricting, for example, then what you're saying is that one leg of that stool should be longer and more powerful than the rest. That dismantles our American democracy. That dismantles checks and balances. And you see it over and over again. At CPD, we believe that the only way out of here, out of this moment, is through investment in people, in civic participation, and increasing our political power and voice. That's why today I'm out there knocking on doors, talking to people with our affiliate in Pennsylvania, or one of our affiliates in Pennsylvania, and making sure that through the rest of this week, we are making sure that every vote gets counted, that people have the trust in their government and electoral process. And to be frank, to continue to talk to voters about how they take their rightful place in self-governance and right this ship, because things have definitely gone sideways.
And then finally, Anna Lilia, the corporate media bears responsibility because they're the ones who have the power to set the agenda. And all we've been hearing for the past 6 months is inflation, inflation, inflation. And this means Republicans could win because they are so much better or seen as so much better on the economy. There can be a reframing of the debate to things that actually matter. But that doesn't happen because alongside those headlines screaming up about inflation, we don't enough see that corporate profits are at an all-time high. We also don't see enough that the measures of the economy are disconnected from the measures of how people are surviving. And so it's taken as an accepted assumption that in order to bring down inflation, we have to increase interest rates and we have to increase unemployment. I mean, amazing to me that the corporate media seems okay with this and aren't calling this out as loudly as possible.
It is unbelievable that the way we dig ourselves out, to your point, the way that we dig ourselves out of an economic crisis is by inflicting strategic, targeted, and sustained pain to those who are most vulnerable. I want you to think about, folks who are listening, to think about who will be the first to get fired, who will have the hardest time securing a job. And this is coming out of a pandemic where we rightfully understood that in order to counter rampant poverty, rampant child hunger, the instability of families, was to move money in people's pockets so that people could then participate in our economy. We are a very much a service-driven, a consumer-driven economy. And if consumers do not have the ability to participate, then we're going to continue to see an economic or feel the economic pain. What we again deeply believe is that it is important for regular people to not only get informed about what's happening, but engage. So that means going to city council meetings, to county committee meetings, county board meetings, and most certainly showing up at your elected officials' offices. But, you know, our democracy is not a spectator sport. You have to jump in and participate. And again, the ideas that we support are popular ideas, are transformative ideas. And if we get together and raise our voices, we can and must win. I mean, everything depends on it.
Give out a website where people can find out more about the work that you do.
Yeah, for sure. It's PopularDemocracy.org. I will say that we're on social media, on Instagram, on, you know, as of now, still on Twitter, but we shall see.
We'll post a link to that from our website as well.
Yes, please. And we have affiliates across the country. And for folks who are interested in engaging, we offer multiple opportunities in your state or very near you.
Thank you again so much, Anna Lilia, for joining us today. Good luck to you.
Thank you. Thank you.
My guest has been Anna Lilia Mejia, co-executive director of the Center for Popular Democracy Action, former deputy director of the U.S. Department of Labor Women's Bureau, and former political director on the Bernie Sanders 2020 campaign. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com. By becoming a subscriber, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Voters often turn out in larger numbers during presidential races compared to midterms. But this year, with former President Trump raring to make a comeback and Republicans spreading misinformation in order to regain political power, it seems like the November 8th, 2022 election may be the most important midterm election of our modern era. Writing in Yes Magazine, my colleague Chris Winters explains that, quote, a huge number of Republican candidates for key statewide offices, including those overseeing elections, are election deniers who deny that President Joe Biden won the 2020 election or insist without evidence that he won only because of fraud. Chris is senior editor at Yes Magazine, where he specializes in covering democracy and the economy. He's been a journalist for more than 20 years, writing for newspapers and magazines in the Seattle area, and his latest story is entitled The Most Important Midterm Election. Welcome to the program, Chris.
Hi, thank you, Sonali. Glad to be here.
So why is the fear of fascism not overblown this time around? We've had, you know, corporate media often likes to say sliding into fascism or semi-fascism or the path to fascism, but it seems as though it's knocking at our door this time.
That is true. And, you know, unlike when, for example, I was in college and sitting in my dorm room and talking about all the fascists out there, this, you know, this isn't overblown this time around. Fascism and right-wing extremism in general, in a variety of different types, is on the rise around the world, and in the U.S. as well. And we are seeing it, you know, it's always been part of American culture. It's always been kind of underground. And what we saw over the past six or seven years is that when, you know, with the rise of Donald Trump, he basically gave carte blanche for those people to just kind of be open about it. And so we're seeing it all up on the surface right now.
So when we look at the election specifically, how is it manifesting itself? We were seeing armed vigilantes at some ballot boxes, and we're seeing Republicans be quite open in their desire to rig the system so that they can cheat their way into power. I mean, it used to be the thing that wasn't said out loud. These days, it's just being said out loud. Is that one indication to you in this midterm election that we're in such a dangerous moment?
Absolutely. I mean, if we're seeing a lot of election deniers on the ballots, as you mentioned in your introduction here, Washington Post has counted 291. I guess your definition of what an election denier is, it could be, there's a little bit of gray area in debate, you know, whether it's, is this person truly an election denier, or are they just a Trump patsy, and, you know, without actually denying the 2020 election's validity. So I think that there's, you know, a lot of that out there. A lot of them are essentially, especially at the local races, at the state level, they're running because they do not want to see a repeat of 2020 in which their guy loses. They want to ensure that he will win. And we saw Trump tried very, very hard to try to get state officials to throw the election to him. He failed. But what the Republican Party took away from that is, oops, we got caught committing a coup, we shouldn't do that. What they said is, oh, we didn't have the right planning in place to make sure the coup would succeed. So now we're going to do that and put all the right people in place so that when 2024 rolls around, there won't be any problem. We'll just be able to say he wins and it's over.
Chris, Democrats thought that the Supreme Court's overturning of the right to an abortion would drive people to the poll. And you point out in your article that it did in special races earlier in the year that were quite close to the decision when the matter was fresh in people's minds. Is timing going to be a problem? I mean, it seems so bizarre to talk about, well, if only the Supreme Court had overturned abortion a little closer to the midterms, and maybe, you know, maybe that timing was an issue for them, for the conservatives on the court. But is timing an issue around the abortion thing?
I think so, yes. And I think that, you know, the Kansas special election, which was kind of a rout in a lot of ways, you know, and surprised a lot of people, and says, oh my gosh, goodness, you know, the midterms will be about abortion. I think as we get closer to the polls, and we've seen a lot of campaigning coming out, you know, especially from the Republican side, trying to talk about anything except abortion, I think that has gotten allowed us to get distracted in some ways. And, you know, inflation and crime are the two big issues the Republicans are trumpeting. And like a lot of things, inflation is up, but it's a global phenomenon. And in the US, it's actually quite moderate compared to the rest of the world. Crime is also up, but it's nowhere near the highs that we experienced in decades past. So there's some context that's missing, and it's not being picked up on, I don't think. And so it's confusing the information environment out there. So yeah, I mean, abortion, it is a big issue, and there are definitely people out there who are voting as if, you know, this is the number one issue. I think that there's been a very concerted effort to get this election to be about anything else. And in some cases, in a lot of places, that's actually gaining traction.
Right. We saw some Republicans in debates leading up to the election try to have it both ways by not being very clear or specific about how they wanted or what their plans were for codifying abortion bans in their states. We saw in the debate between John Fetterman and Mehmet Oz, where Dr. quote unquote Oz essentially said that he wouldn't get in the way, but that, you know, maybe some political elected leaders might get in the way, and he hoped nobody would notice. Some people did, but it's not clear how many actually did. Now, I'm wondering if you think that this idea that government spending, directly spending to help people, you know, is something that the Democrats have done but haven't maybe touted enough, something that the Republicans claim is the slide towards socialism. How is that seen by voters? Because voters are struggling financially, even pre-inflation. And yet, time and again, Republicans manage to convince enough voters that government shouldn't be there to take taxpayer money to help taxpayers.
Yeah, this is something that I've written about more than once in the past. Democrats have a real messaging problem in that it seems like they're just almost too timid to trumpet their own victories when they get them. And these are things like, the Biden administration in general has passed a number of really substantial policies in its first 2 years, but you wouldn't know it by paying attention to the campaign environment out there right now. It's just getting overshadowed. They're not being very good at trumpeting. And it's like, yes, we have record numbers of job growth, for example. A lot of things are happening. Gas prices are even falling right now. You wouldn't know that if you were listening to the Republicans. So yeah, there's a lot of things out there that the Democrats could be talking about, but they're not unified in the message. And I think part of the reason is that their message is complicated. I made a point in an online conversation not too long ago. It's like the Republicans are telling a very consistent story that has emotional resonance. And it's this emotional arc, people can grab onto it. I mean, politically, as I think John Stewart pointed out, you can fit their entire platform on the front of a trucker cap. But Democrats don't have anything comparable. They're not telling a story that has emotional resonance. They require you to go out and learn what the carried interest tax loophole actually means so that you could make an informed decision about what, spending programs are going to be worth. So yeah, and social services spending programs, that falls right into that category. Democrats love to talk about policies. They're not telling stories that the voters can intuitively grasp, usually. And I think that's something that they've got to get better at.
Chris, do you think that Democratic voters feel motivated enough to go to the polls because they see what's at stake? I mean, is it possible, I guess I'm asking, is it possible that this midterm election will go a different way than what we've seen in the past, where the president's party tends to lose in their first midterm? There's a meme floating around saying, as you go into the ballot box, remember January 6th, that is the most important thing that you should remember. And I'm wondering if that story is cutting through.
I think in some sectors it is. There are some signs that, and I was looking for this earlier, early voting has trended upward, especially on the Democratic side. I mean, Republicans are voting in higher numbers earlier too, I think, this midterms. But definitely, Democrats, those who are motivated to vote based upon these very salient issues are getting out there and they are voting. There's no question about that. The question is, what's going to happen on election day itself as people go to the polls? And are they, are these folks who are, really motivated, they're highly partisan voters, or are they people who are going to the polls because it's election day and they haven't really been paying that much attention over the past couple of years, but they're going in there and whatever's going to be front of mind is going to be what they've been talking about over the breakfast table for the past couple of days, and that's about it. So how that actually plays out as votes are cast and tallied in the days following election day, it won't be over on election night, that's for certain. A lot of that is going to be, it's kind of wait and see. I mean, a lot of the big races that I'm going to be paying attention to, especially the Senate races, they're all really, really close. They're all within the margin of error, all the polls are. So it's kind of, our elections have always been a turnout game. And whichever side gets the highest turnout usually ends up winning, because there's just so many people who don't turn out.
And that's why for those Senate races that are so close, where Republicans are able to invalidate just enough votes, they could effectively steal. And with the Senate up for grabs, with such a thin, razor thin margin of control that the Democrats, are looking like they might lose. We won't really know for a few days, as you mentioned. theft, voter theft is really important as well. Well, Chris, your article in Yes is called The Most Important Midterm Election. Summarize for us in a nutshell why it is the most important. We've had some really important elections, and 2018's midterm elections were really surprising in terms of how many progressive new members of Congress who are people of color got elected. And, you know, of course, we have a different political reality now. So why is this midterm election the most important one?
This is kind of the election that I think is going to demonstrate for us just how powerful local state offices really are in our political system. That's something else I've written about in the past, but you know, a lot of political power rests at the state level. And we are seeing a large number of Republicans who are election deniers, and more Republicans who may not be, you know, literally deniers, but are quite firmly in the Trump camp. They're running for these local offices: governor, secretary of state, attorney general. These are the offices that are going to have an impact over how the next election in 2024 is going to be run. And this is kind of like, you know, part two of the coup plan, essentially. Get their people in the right places so that when the time comes, they will be able to make the election go the way they want it to go and not the way the voters go.
So and I we've think seen conservatives in this country be very good at playing the long game. I mean, the abortion decision illustrated that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they've been working on overturning Roe v. Wade since Roe v. Wade was first enacted or first decided by the Supreme Court. So yeah, Republicans do play a very long game, and Democrats have not been able to do that very much. You know, Republicans have been seating people into school boards, into local city councils, in state legislatures. They have control of about half of the state legislatures in the country, and some of them they have super majorities. They've really built up a very deep bench of talent, of people who can rise up to the national level and who can make decisions at the local level. And it seems that at least since, I want to say, at least since about 2004, I think that was when Howard Dean unveiled his 50 state plan for Congress. I think it's been that long since we've actually had a national strategy that wasn't just kind of picking high profile races and this is where we're going to emphasize. So I think, yeah, it's an important midterm election, especially because it is a midterm and turnout typically is lower than in general elections. I think I've read somewhere that it runs typically 20 points below a general election that usually. So,
but of course, we never know, because since 2016, I feel like any predictions have to come with a giant grain of salt.
And take any poll that you see with a grain of salt too. I mean, we have seen how they can be very, very wrong in the past, and there is a science, but it's a very inexact science behind polling. And we're going to see, you know, as I think Talking Points memos Josh Marshall was pointing out, you know, we're going to see who wins and loses after Election Day, but we're also going to see which pollsters are winning and which are losing, because some of them are going to be really wrong.
Chris, finally, let's examine the worst case scenario. Worst case scenario, Republicans, you know, and I mean that not for Democrats. I mean that worst case scenario for democracy, for people's rights, for voting rights, for abortion rights. Republicans say they sweep the House and the Senate. Biden has control for two more years. Obviously, as you mentioned, they're going to spend these next 2 years laying the groundwork for Trump to return to power. What else are they going to do? I mean, all Biden can do is stave off every bit of legislation that they put forward, including probably a national abortion ban, as you point out in your article. He's just going to be able to hold the line, and he's not going to be able to pass, of course, any legislation, because Republicans made very clear since Obama came into power that they will veto or not be part of any significant legislation simply because it might benefit a Democrat politically, regardless of whether it benefits people.
Republicans are not really interested in governing right now. So their plan is basically to make the Democrats look bad any way they can. And, you know, they will try to pass things. Biden's going to veto them. So it's going to be a circus. And that's the long and short of it. The things to watch out for are going to be in those must-pass bills, the ones that they authorize the federal budget. raising the debt ceiling, which gives the government that spending power to pay the issues that are in the budget, which is kind of a weird system anyways that needs to change, but whatever. There is every indication that the Republicans are going to use the debt ceiling as a bargaining chip. And they're going to say, you know, we will not do this. We will force the country to default on its debts unless you give me A, B, and C. And that would be, you know, some kind of political concession. Something, you know, their issues are abortion. They want to get rid of Social Security. They want to get rid of Medicare. They want to get rid of Medicaid. They want to get rid of the Affordable Care Act. They want to, you know, do all sorts of things around the cultural fringe that they may or may not be legally able to do, but they're going to try anyways because that's what they do. And they're going to use the debt ceiling as their vehicle to try and ram through some of that stuff. So that's where we're really going to watch. And in the meantime, by playing chicken with the debt ceiling like this, they're holding the entire world economy hostage. Because if the U.S. doesn't pay its debts, that's going to undermine the entire economic system around the globe. So it's a bit esoteric, but it's really, really important. And they've done it before, and they are definitely going to do it again because they are determined to undermine Biden any way they can. And they'll also try to impeach him. Right. Reasons to be determined later, but, you know, that's the plan, you know.
Revenge for the impeachments against Trump.
Absolutely, yeah. They are about seizing power and taking revenge on their enemies, and very little else, really.
Chris, I want to thank you so much for joining us. We'll post a link to your story in Yes Magazine. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sonali.
My guest has been Chris Winters, senior editor at Yes Magazine, where he specializes in covering democracy and the economy. He's also my colleague. I'm the racial justice editor at Yes as well. And we've been talking about his latest story, The Most Important Midterm Election. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. When the Supreme Court earlier this year overturned nearly 50 years of settled constitutional law protecting the right to an abortion, Democrats hoped the momentum from public anger over the decision would pull voters to the polls in the 2022 midterms. Now, a new collection of essays, Aftermath: Life in Post-Roe America, offers a searing look at the critical role that abortion rights have played in improving the lives of women and pregnant people, and what's at stake as it's overturned. It also examines a future without Roe and what options there are to secure reproductive freedom in the future. My guest is Elizabeth Hines, author and editor of Aftermath, Life in Post-Roe America. The book features essays by Jessica Valenti, Alyssa Milano, Soraya Chamali, Michelle Goodwin, and many others, including myself. Welcome to the program, Liz.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
So obviously the book was a high-speed turnaround, given that it went from being planned to published in a few months. I imagine you might have expected that the Supreme Court would do what it did. But tell me about what was the impetus for you to put such a book together?
It was very fast. And the impetus was anger and disbelief and rage. I am the mother of three children, and the night that that Justice Alito's draft decision was leaked, my phone started lighting up with text messages from friends of mine, you know, who were parents, who are parents, and who, you know, were going back and forth, you know, texting each other saying, what do we do now? What are we going to do to protect our children's lives and their freedom and their bodily autonomy? And, you know, the next morning after I spent sort of a fitful night, you know, reading nonstop all of the news stories that were coming out, I woke up the next morning and I was chatting with a friend and, you know, she really sort of put it to me. She said, well, yes, this is terrible, but what are you going to do about it? And I said, well, you know, I'm going to vote and I'm going to donate money and what, you know, and she said, no, but really, what are you going to do? And that challenge really moved me in a way to sort of, you know, this moment of saying, listen, we all have gifts and skills and talents. And how are we each going to use them to try to drive change, the kind of change we would like to see? And because I have a background in writing and journalism, I sort of understood pretty quickly that the way that I was going to try to help out was by collecting the voices of journalists and everyday people and experts in various fields who would be willing to talk about what the loss of these rights was going to mean to American society. And so that's what we did. I reached out to lots and lots of people, and yourself included, and yeah. You know, so many just said, yes, absolutely, let's do it. And I think it was also helped along by the fact that the proceeds from this book are going to help fund abortion care providers who are doing really critical work to support women and pregnant people in states all across this country.
One of the important things is that we hear stories of the personal impact. Tell me how in the book Aftermath, we hear the kind of personal responses to the loss of abortion rights, because ultimately it's lives at stake, right? It's people's well-being and lives at stake, rather than, you know, the political calculations are secondary, but it's people's lives.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, I think unsurprisingly, the people who contributed to this book, you know, were all in a state of feeling, you know, quite outraged and you know, quite committed to standing up to try to improve the current state of affairs. You know, I think what each of these people brought in their own way. Some of these stories are personal. Some of these are stories of people who did have, you know, who were raped and had an abortion. Some of them, you know, became pregnant unintentionally and had an abortion. Some of them became pregnant intentionally and realized somewhere along their pregnancy journey that there was a medical issue that was going to force them to terminate a very much wanted pregnancy. One of the things that's really important to me about this collection is that it really offers a range of experiences along the abortion spectrum, right? So, you know, for some people, having an abortion was the most devastating thing that they've had to do in their lives. For other people, it was not the most devastating thing. It was a choice that they made at a point in their lives that was the right choice for them. And I think we have to allow ourselves to be honest about the fact that every person is an individual and every person has a different relationship to their body and what they would like to have happen in their body. So I really hope that we can increasingly make room for a diversity of stories about reproductive health. They don't all hew to the same line. And that should be okay. Right.
One of the pieces that really moved me was Rebecca Traister's story, her essay in Aftermath, "The Abortion Stories We Didn't Tell, How Decades of Silence Left Us Unprepared for the Post-Roe Fight." And there's so much blame to go around, right, Liz? We didn't hear enough about early enough to change the culture in our newspapers, in even movies and television shows. And so the right and the anti-abortion right ended up winning the storytelling fight, if you will, by conflating, you know, fetal cells with life, with, you know, electrical impulses on an ultrasound with actual living babies. And it seemed as though they managed to make much more headway in the storytelling aspect of how, you know, of birth and pregnancy, rather than the advocates of the right to an abortion.
Yeah, I think that's that jives with how I think about it, you know. And you know, I would say that for me, when you have a right, you know, when you have something like Roe v. Wade codified in law, and when you are a person like me, you know, I was born in 1975. I grew up in a country in which, yes, there were challenges to abortion rights, but it was our right, and it was impossible, really, for so many folks who were not spending their lives working in the reproductive justice movement to really grasp how fragile that right was. You know, when you talk to people who were working in these fields, they were clear long ago that, you know, this was going to be something that really could fall, right? And I want to give those people a lot of credit for trying very hard to knock on the doors of the rest of us and say, hey, by the way, we really have to be concerned, right? This election of 2020 matters tremendously, right? Because whoever is president may get to, you know, put a bunch of people on the Supreme Court. And that is exactly what happened. And I think, you know, I don't want to miss how hard people who were working in reproductive justice and reproductive health were working to try to alert the rest of us that this really was something that was very fragile. I think they tried very hard. I think, you know, mainstream media and many of those of us who were not spending our daily lives doing this work kind of got into this bubble of like, I can't, you know, it's just so hard to believe, right? And I don't blame us, frankly, either, because the Supreme Court has not done a lot of taking away of human rights, right? But that's what they did here.
Liz, can you give me a sense of the angle that is so critical to reproductive justice, which is how race plays into it and how those stories are told in the book Aftermath? Women of color in particular, people of color are disproportionately impacted by abortion bans. And which are the voices that you feature in Aftermath that bring that up? And what's the gist of some of their arguments?
Yeah, it was really important to me in doing this book that we have a racial diversity in our authors. You know, I mean, I think so much of the storytelling that has happened historically has foregrounded the experiences of white straight women. And I think, you know, our lives are far more complicated than that. And there are far more, you know, perspectives out there in the world that need to be given, you know, an opportunity to raise their voice. And so, you know, I mean, what I heard from, you know, people who are working on the ground, there are three essays in this book that are actually Q&As that I did with folks who work, you know, on the ground with people who are seeking abortion. So we talked to Robin Marty, who is the author of The Essential Guide to, you know, Abortion Access in the United States. And, you know, she works at the West Alabama Women's Clinic, and she talked to me about who the people are who are, you know, seeking abortions in the state of Alabama. And, you know, she pointed out most of them are already mothers. Most of them are people, women of color, Black women. Most of them already do not have great economic resources. And I do think, again, being honest about the fact that, you know, if you are a person of means, you know, you will continue to be able to find a way in this country to access abortion care, right? You'll be able to get on a plane, most likely. You'll be able to fly to where you need to go. You probably, maybe you work a job that has, you know, paid sick leave, or, you know, you can take a day off from work and not have to worry that, you know, you'll either get fired or you won't be paid for that day's work. But there are, you know, millions of people across this country who have no such privilege. And these bans are affecting their lives in, you know, truly devastating ways. And I think it's also important to remember that, you know, when these bans go into place in red states, for example, you know, lots of clinics are now having to shut down in, you know, across the South and in places in the Midwest. And that causes a problem not merely for those seeking abortion, right? These are clinics that offer a wide variety of reproductive health care. And when their doors have to close, we then shut off millions of people from healthcare beyond abortion, right? We've shut them off from being able to access birth control, from being able to have well person visits, for being able to lead a healthy life. And so, you know, I think, and all of that, you know, of course, because this is America, has a racial component to it. So, you know, I hope that, you know, those who can read this book, who buy this book, can read some of the perspectives about how how the loss of these rights disproportionately affects people of color. It disproportionately affects people with disabilities, trans folks. You know, we are not in this country all created equal. We're just not. We don't live those lives yet.
And I'd like to point out, as I did in my essay in the book, that there are plenty of right-wing anti-abortion women who end up going into clinics quietly seeking abortion, seeing themselves as exceptions and, you know, being protected by doctor-patient or medical confidentiality, and then going right back around to the front of the clinic to protest the clinic and call for its closure. And that hypocrisy is something that really needs to be called out as well. Yifat Suskind, one of the other contributors to the book, Aftermath, Life in Post-Roe America, points out that there is there are lessons to be learned from other nations. And we've seen in Latin America, in Europe, in countries that are very Catholic and traditionally expected to be anti-abortion, where they've codified the right to an abortion into law. So let's turn finally to that aspect of the story, because how can the United States restore the right to an abortion, restore the right to bodily autonomy, such a basic fundamental right, in the future by looking at what others have done elsewhere?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think what you saw in Latin America was certainly that people got out in the streets, you know, that women were willing to march in the streets and stand up for their rights and demand that their concerns be taken seriously. I think we have some work to do here in the United States to continue to push in that kind of way. You know, when I spoke to these folks who work in organizations that provide these services, you know, when I interview people, I always ask, you know, is there anything that you would like me to share that I haven't asked you yet? And what I found when I asked, you know, the folks who are actually doing this work, you know, what it was they wanted people to know about how we can keep things, you know, moving in a positive direction, the thing that every single one of them pointed out was this need to think about how we are resourcing the work that is going to go on to continue to move, you know, abortion rights, reproductive health rights forward in a positive and inclusive way.
Thank you again, Liz, so much for joining us today and for the work that you've done to put this book forward.
Thank you for being a part of it, Sonali. We're so grateful.
My guest has been Elizabeth Hines, author and editor. She edited the new book, Aftermath, Life in Postro America. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy award-winning band Gets Up. Like us on facebook.com/RU with Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO.